You're a podcast listener, and this is a podcast ad. Reach great listeners like yourself with podcast advertising from Lips and Ads. Choose from hundreds of top podcasts offering host endorsements, or run a reproduced ad like this one across thousands of shows to reach your target audience with Lips and Ads. Go to lipsandads.com now. That's LIBSYNads.com.
Welcome to Intelligence Squared. I'm Connor Boyle. Following the shocking attack on Salman Rushdie last Friday, many of the acclaimed author's friends and admirers have joined in praising a singular literary talent and his extraordinary courage. Here at Intelligence Squared, Rushdie has appeared across numerous events and recordings over the years, and we wish him a swift recovery. We wanted to play you one of those recordings today from the Intelligence Squared archive. The episode you're about to hear was recorded as part of our 2021 series, Touchstones with Razia Iqbal. Rushdie talks about his love of James Joyce, Bob Dylan, and the amulet his father gave him as a young boy. Here's Razia with more.
Now, we all have touchstones, points of reference that we return to and that hold our interest throughout our lives, things that offer hope, comfort and inspiration. Now, it could be a book, it could be a poem, a film, a painting, a song, an object, even a place, anything. It's their choice in their history. I'm delighted today to introduce my guest, the writer Salman Rushdie. It's not an overstatement to say that his second novel, Midnight's Children, changed literary fiction. It won the Booker Prize and was voted the prize's best of Booker on two separate occasions. It has sold more than 1 million copies in the UK alone. He influenced an entire generation of South Asian writers, though not only them. He sparked a revolution in post-colonial literature with his distinctive style, as well as chronicling the lives of those in the diaspora. His latest novel, Quixote, is a wild ride through modern America and society on the verge of social and moral collapse. Salman, a very warm welcome. Salman, let's start with just simply getting you to tell us what you have chosen as your three touchstones.
Well, the first one is an object. It's actually the first thing I was ever given in my life. I was given it when I was 1 day old. And it's a piece of silver. It's a little silver ingot about an inch high, which is engraved with the unpartitioned map of India. Because, you know, when I was born, it was 2 months before the partition. So in those days, Pakistan didn't exist. So it was given to me by one of my father's friends. And I've kept it with me ever since, always somewhere close by. And second thing is a story, which is, I'm a big Joyce fan, so it's difficult to know what bit of Joyce to choose, but I chose his short story, The Dead, from Dubliners, which I think has some claim to be one of the very greatest, if not the greatest, short story in the language. And the third one is the well-known Nobel Literature Laureate, Bob Dylan. And I've chosen his song, Mr. Tambourine Man, which again, I mean, I could have chosen 100 different songs, but I chose that one.
Fantastic. They all sound wonderful. I'm so looking forward to talking about them in detail. Let's start with the ingot. So the oldest thing that you possess, given to you when you were 1 day old, what does it mean to you? What is it about this that has made you hold on to it?
Well, I mean, first of all, it just is a link to a childhood which I remember with great affection. You know, I mean, my unlike the hero of Midnight's Children, whose childhood is somewhat fraught and troubled, I remember my childhood as being all sort of uneventfully happy. And this little piece of silver sort of takes me back to not just to the time, but actually to the place where I grew up and the neighborhood, you know, and all of that. And I'm kind of amazed that I never lost it. Because, I mean, when I was a kid, my dad used to keep it locked up and I would have to ask to see it because he didn't trust me. But when I went to boarding school in England, he gave it to me to bring with me. And somehow, amazingly, through 4.5 years of a rugby school education, I failed to lose it. And nobody pitched it. I mean, it's silver. It's worth something. It's a solid.
Well, so it's worth something. Just hold it up for us. And you've described it a little bit, but on it, it says $10, which is about, I think, just over 100 grams in weight. Yeah.
And it's of a very high degree of purity. It's almost 100% pure silver, which is actually purer than the pure silver you get now, you know? So. Yeah, I mean, it has this beautiful little map engraved on it,
and emblazoned with India across it. I wonder about the fundamental narrative of that foundational narrative of India, which it obviously symbolises, and what that means to you, the secular narrative of an India.
Yeah, well, I mean, I'm a child of that generation. I mean, I'm slightly older than the children I wrote about in the novel. But I mean, I'm 8 weeks older, so not a great deal. And I guess I grew up as a person who bought very passionately the idea of Indian secularism, the kind of Nehruvian idea of India. And my family, you know, like many Indian Muslim families, was divided more or less down the middle by the partition. You know, half my relatives were in or went to Pakistan, and an equivalent number decided that they didn't want to do that. You know, that they, and that included, you know, my parents' view, as expressed to me at some point, was that they felt more Indian than Muslim. If you know what I mean, that they didn't want to be in a religious state. They wanted to be in the secular state that was being born. On the Indian side of the frontier. So I remember listening to my parents and people of their generation regretting the partition and wishing that in some way it could have been avoided. And that this map, this unified map, you know, could have remained the case. Because at that time, you know, it was one country. It felt like one country. You know, and even growing up, when I would go with my parents to visit relatives in Karachi or in Rawalpindi, they still felt like the same place. I mean, Pakistan felt more conservative, but they still essentially felt like the same place. And now they don't. Now they don't. You know, now they really feel like very different places.
And also, when you were at school here in Rugby in England, I wonder about the strength that this ingot gave you, because I know that you're very particular about not wanting to call the city that you grew up in Mumbai. You insist on calling it Bombay. And it's those changes that I think mean something in particular to you.
Yeah. I mean, I think about Mumbai the way people who live in Saigon think about Ho Chi Minh City. You know, it's a fake name. And one of the arguments is that whereas there are ancient Indian cities which had ancient Indian names which were then anglicized, you know, like Kolkata becoming Calcutta, like Vadodara becoming Baroda, etc., like Varanasi becoming Benares, it seems to me reasonable that those cities should go back to their traditional names. That if people want to prefer now to say Kolkata, I think fair enough. You know, the difference with Bombay is that it's not an ancient city. It's a city that didn't exist until the British built it. You know, I mean, it was a group of islands and fishing villages. I mean, actually, if you wanted the oldest name, the fisher folk who lived there were called the Koli people. There are still some of them there. And the southern part of the island, as it now is still called Kolaba after them. And that's probably as old a name as you could get, you know. Mumbai is a concocted name, and so I don't use it. It's a generational thing, you know. I mean, I think a lot of people of my generation still say Bombay, and a lot of younger people growing up who've not known anything except Mumbai, you know, say that without a problem.
It sounds as though from when you talk about the amazement that you didn't actually ever lose this ingot, that it has become very precious to you. And I wonder, just picking up on this idea of the foundational narrative of India, what you turn to and what you think about when you look at this ingot in terms of the soul of India today, which is such a different country to the idea that Nehru and Gandhi had.
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, there's the philosopher Sunil Kilnani has a wonderful book called The Idea of India, and he explores this idea of a secularist state, how hard it is for, a very religious country, a country in which almost everybody has religious belief, for everybody to agree with each other that will not be an element of the state, that religion will remain a private matter. It will not be publicly powerful or empowered. And one of the reasons in India for that was precisely because of the partition massacres in which so many Muslims were killed by Hindus and Hindus by Muslims, that the idea was that if you had a sectarian constitution, it would perpetuate that kind of violence. And that the way of keeping the peace was to take religion out of the public arena. And I mean, it worked for a long time. You know, now, as you say, there's an administration in India which is much more a kind of Hindu nationalist government, and is trying with some success to move away from that idea, which I think is a great sadness.
And the ingot, I presume, also connects you very deeply with your father and your parents generally.
Yeah, I mean, it is. It's a reminder of all of that, you know, especially, as I said, because my dad kept it locked up. He wasn't very good at looking after things, actually. I mean, I've often told the story of this first short story I ever wrote, which was based on having seen The Wizard of Oz. And he got his secretary to type it up for me. And then he said, look, if I give it to you, you'll lose it, so I'll look after it. And then he lost it.
Just a wonderful way for us then to get into your next touchstone, which is, in fact, a short story. And it's the last short story in James Joyce's collection, The Dubliners, which was published in 1914. So tell us why this is so important to you.
When I was beginning to think about being a writer, I suppose when I was at Cambridge, and I hadn't really written anything worth mentioning, Joyce was one of the kind of giant figures for me, you know, and in a kind of funny way, because I was going out with somebody who was doing a dissertation on Finnegan's Wake and the French Nouveau Roman. As I must say, as an act of great love, I therefore had to read Finnegan's Wake and a lot of French Nouveau Romancier, Michel Butor, Nathalie Sarraut, etc. Painful experience. And of course, Finnegan's Wake is by far the most complicated and difficult of Joyce's books. You know? And I had trouble with it, as everybody does. And I went sort of backwards through Joyce. So I went from Finnegan's Wake back into Ulysses, and from that back into The Portrait of the Artist as a Young Man, and from that back into the short stories, into Dubliners. And the books become, as you go back in time, they become increasingly accessible. By the time you get to Dubliners, it's just really very beautiful stories. So I do think The Dead is an unbelievably moving story, because, you know, it's about husband and wife, and the husband discovers in the course of the story that his wife has really loved another man who died for her. You know, and he realizes that whatever he does, he can never live up to that. He can never live up to the love of somebody who died for her. And so even though, you know, they don't break up or anything, they're together, but he just has to understand that he will always come second. You know, and that the dead, the power of the dead, is greater than the power of the living.
The particular passage that you return to again and again is the one right at the end. I wonder if you would read it for us.
This is when Gabriel is the man. This is when he's begun to weep, because because he realizes what we've just been saying. He realizes that that the real love of his wife's life is a man who has died, and he goes to look out of the window, and a few light taps on the pane made him turn to the window. It had begun to snow again. He watched sleepily the flakes, silver and dark, falling obliquely against the lamplight. The time had come for him to set out on his journey westward. Yes, the newspapers were right. Snow was general all over Ireland. It was falling on every part of the dark central plain, on the treeless hill, falling softly upon the Bog of Allen, and farther westward, softly falling into the dark, mutinous Shannon waves. It was falling, too, upon every part of the lonely churchyard on the hill where Michael Fury lay buried. It lay thickly drifted on the crooked crosses and headstones, on the spears of the little gate on the barren thorns. His soul swooned slowly as he heard the snow falling faintly through the universe and faintly falling, like the descent of their last end, upon all the living and the dead. I mean, it doesn't get better than that.
It's so beautiful. I wonder if we can just unpack it a little bit through the prism of what it meant to you, because, you know, you could argue that is sort of quite a maudlin reflection, but in fact, it feels like an affirmation of life at the same time, doesn't it?
Yeah, it has the power of intense beauty, you know, and that in a way is a greater power than what it's saying. You know, it's about human life as we live it. You know, here, Michael Fury, the young man who's referred to in the passage, is the dead man that his wife used to love. You know, and the snow is falling at the beautiful reversal, falling faintly, faintly falling, over all the living and the dead. You know, in a way, the living and the dead are united by the snow. You know, I've always remembered when John Huston made his film of the dead. It's a very good film with Angelica Huston and Gabriel Byrne as the married couple. And at the very end of the film, when we've had this whole emotional scene, you know, the camera simply does what the story does. The camera turns to the window and looks out at the window, and there's snow falling outside. And instead of there being actors acting, a voiceover comes in and just reads that passage, you know. What it felt to me watching the film was that we had gone from watching a very good film to hearing genius, you know, and that there's a difference between the very good and the great. You know? That passage of Joyce actually just made me think, okay, that really just is as good as it gets. You can't write better than that. And actually, it scared me. Joyce's work scared me, because when I, as a young man, read it, I thought, well, what are you going to do? He's done it. You know, it's all done here, and you know, I can't do this. It must be like a young 19 or 20 year old writer who wants to be a playwright reading Shakespeare, and thinking, oh, I may as well give up.
but I mean, you might have thought that when you first read it, but I wonder what it is then that brings you back to it again and again. I mean, it's obviously the aesthetics of it. It's completely beautiful to read again, but I also wonder about the impact that it makes on you as a writer.
Yeah, well, I think Joyce in general, you know, because people think of him as difficult. And as I say, Finnegan's Wake, very difficult, but the other stuff, not so much really, you know. And I think what people miss when they are scared off Joyce, you know, is the very deep humanity of his writing, you know, his incredibly deep love of human beings, so, and wonderful writer of women, you know. I mean, Molly Bloom's soliloquy at the end of Ulysses is maybe the best piece of writing that a man has ever done about a woman's interior life. And very funny. You know, there's a lot of Joyce that is very funny. And also it has the quality of great literature, which is that every time you read it, it gives you something else. It gives you something you didn't have the previous time. Partly that's because you change. You know, I mean, when I first read Dubliners, when I first read Ulysses, I was no more than 20 years old. You know, that's more than half a century ago. No, I've read these stories and this novel three or four times in the interim, you know, and they feel like somewhat different texts each time, because I'm bringing something different to it.
There's also, it occurs to me that the story is also about Gabriel's observation that everyone, himself included, will only one day be a memory when he talks about the dead. And I wonder, as you have gone back to this story, whether you think about your own legacy at all.
Yeah, I mean, I just hope there is one. I mean, obviously, if you write sort of my kind of books rather than kind of pulp fiction, there's a part of you that is writing for posterity. There's a part of you that hopes that these books will outlive you. You know, that they, I mean, I remember Martin Amis having this nice phrase once where he said that, you know, when what he wanted to leave behind was a shelf of books. You know, he wanted to be able to say, like, from here to here, it's me, you know, and that's what you hope for, you know, and you have no idea if it's going to happen. I mean, I know there are so many cases of writers who were enormously celebrated in their lifetimes who fell into obscurity, you know, quite soon afterwards. And vice versa, writers who were not so well regarded in their lifetime who became part of the fabric of the literary canon, you know, so you never know. You know, all you can do is put it out there. I mean, I like it. You know, if I look at some of the older books, like Midnight Children, for example, that it's now, I mean, 1981. It's almost 40 years since it came out. It's 45 years since I started writing it. And the fact that people still find it valuable, that there are still readers who respond well to it, that feels great, you know, because that means that it's leapt a couple of generations already, you know. And if it could go on doing that, then maybe it'll stick around. You know? But that's, yeah, I mean, that's what, of course you think about that, you know, or at least, I mean, you don't think about it when you're writing, you know. You can't write for the future. You know, you have to write for the people who might pick up your book while you're still around.
Yeah, I mean, of course, anything can happen to any one of us at any time. And but it does occur to me that you lived with the actual threat of death for a very long time with the Iranian fatwa. And I wonder, in that context, how much literature going back to the same thing again and again meant an awful lot more to you. And this in particular, this story in particular.
Yeah, it helped a lot, literature. You know, I mean, just to have the history of literature to think about, you know, and the fact is that I'm not the first writer to have had a difficult time. You know, Dostoevsky faced a firing squad, and it was a pretend firing squad. They didn't actually shoot him, but he didn't know that. You know, he didn't know that it was just being done to scare him. And you know, Joyce himself had a very difficult life politically. I mean, he was in exile from Ireland most of his life. And his relationship with Ireland was very sad. I mean, so much so that when he died, his widow, Nora Joyce, they were broke, you know, and she asked for the help of the Irish government to repatriate his body. And the help was refused. And, you know, now he's an industry in Ireland, you know, in the way that now there's a bridge named after Samuel Beckett, another person that they didn't like.
In the story, Gabriel Conroy says at one point, we are living in a skeptical, thought-tormented age. And that could apply to today, right?
Yeah. And I mean, actually, that's the other thing I think that you get from reading Joyce now, is that even though he disapproved of the idea that literature should be political, his literature is full of politics. Don't listen to what writers say, look at what they do. Joyce had this idea that writing should be, he said, static, not dynamic, by which he meant it should simply be. It should not attempt to persuade or to argue. It should be a kind of essence rather than a kind of polemic. And fair enough, except that his In the Dead, there's a political argument, where people are talking about the Irish politics of the time. And Ulysses is full of people, varying degrees of sobriety, having political arguments. So politics is all there all the time in him. And yet he doesn't make the mistake of making his books based on political issues, and as a result, they don't date, that's, I think, was a lesson that I learned, which is that it's one thing to say public affairs are a part of private life. And so if you're going to understand the private life, that needs to be a dimension that you include. But the point is to make it a dimension which explains your characters and their lives, rather than making it the subject. If you make it the subject, then, we live in an age, even more so than when Joyce was writing, we live in an age in which things move very fast, the subject changes very fast. And if your book is too rigidly linked to a particular matter, then it becomes like yesterday's papers, And I mean, I was worried about this actually when I was writing Midnight's Children, because at the climax of Midnight's Children, there is this period in the mid-70s in India called the emergency, when Mrs. Gandhi suspended democracy for about 3 years and took on authoritarian powers. And the book has a strong point of view about that, But I remember when I was writing the book, worrying that, a time would come at some point when nobody cared about Indira Gandhi or the emergency. And I remember saying to myself, when that happens, this book is either going to get worse or it's going to get better. It's either going to be damaged by being too topical, when that topicality has faded. Or people will see that the underlying drive of the book, its characters and story, in a way, emerge, when that topicality is lessened. I didn't know which it would be. I literally didn't know.
Of course. And it's so interesting, isn't it, that we live in the middle of this incredible debate about cancel culture, which does sit in a period of real polarization of, freedom of speech versus authoritarianism, and people saying, you don't have the right to say this, but I do. And I wonder how you reflect on that as a writer who is still keen to continue writing. I mean, I imagine that you're never going to stop writing until you can't anymore.
Well, I hope not. Yeah. I mean, I sometimes envy Philip Roth for having had the strength to stop, but I don't plan to stop. Look, I mean, here's the thing about, first of all, who owns material? This question about appropriation. My view is nobody owns material. Anybody can write about anything, because otherwise, men could only write about men, and women could only write about women, and short people could only write about short people, and fat people could only write about fat people, and so on. It becomes very quickly ludicrous. But that doesn't mean that you can be lazy about it, especially if you're stepping away from your own experience of life to enter into a very radically other experience of life, whether that's racially other or sexually other or whatever it might be, then it becomes your business to get that right, and to find out about experiences which are not your own. and write out of that knowledge. You know, I think write what you know is fair enough, but then sometimes you have to increase what you know in order to be able to write. And then there's the other question which I have great sympathy with, which is the question of power: who gets to hold the microphone, who is denied that? And I think that conversation that's happening right now, across the media, it happening in television, is happening in the film industry, it's happening in book publishing, etc. I think that's a very important and valuable conversation. That more sorts of people need to be able to have access to speech, I saw the other day, I know there's been this fuss about Annie Leibovitz did a cover of took a photograph of Simone Biles for Vogue, and everybody thought it was a terrible picture. And then meanwhile, a young black photographer took a picture of Viola Davis for the cover of Vanity Fair, and it's a fantastic picture, and basically he knew how to light black skin. And it's not that, Annie's taken pictures of black people before. She's taken pictures of Michelle Obama and Oprah Winfrey and Serena Williams and, all sorts of people, but she got this one wrong. But the thing that amazed me was the fact that this young man, who I'm ashamed to say I can't remember his name, is the first black photographer ever to be asked to take the cover photograph for Vanity Fair, ever. And that's what I mean by power. So I think the argument sometimes crosses into two or three different arguments. I think the question of power, the question of being able to enter other realities, and how do you do that? That's one set of questions. The question of silencing opinions that you don't agree with, to my mind is another question, because historically, and certainly in my own experience, the force, the pressure for censorship comes from the right wing, and it comes, if generationally, it comes from an older generation, and younger people are more iconoclastic, more willing to throw out the garbage of the old, and the left traditionally has been the in favor of free expression, and what we now see, that's still happening. Sitting here in New York, where the Trump administration conducts a daily attack on the freedom of the press, such as I've never seen in a democracy. So there is still that pressure from the right to limit speech. But now there's a kind of pressure from the left, from what people would call themselves progressives, to outlaw certain kinds of utterance. And I've always thought of free democracy as being like the town square. That there you are in the town square, and it's not, it's an argument. Everybody's having an argument, and the argument never ends. But the ability to have the argument is what I would call freedom, because in dictatorships, the first thing that happens is people shut down the argument, And so I think when the pressure comes from the right and the left, that space for debate is squeezed, and I worry about that.
Sponsoring the show for this episode is Marquee TV. Marquee TV is a streaming service with a difference. It's bringing you the top tier of performing arts straight into your living room or onto your device. So think dance, theatre, music, anything you might find in the West End, Broadway, or maybe a cool little experimental space too, but saving you the cost of a few tickets as well. I've got happily a bit lost in their vast library of performances, exclusive interviews, and behind-the-scenes content. Choreographer Jonathan Watkins' interpretation of George Orwell's classic 1984 was pretty cool, and I love the dance piece Sutra, inspired by the skills of Buddhist Shaolin monks. And we've got a special treat for our listeners. Marquee TV offers 3 months of access for just 99 cents. That's right, 3 months for only 99 cents with the code squared. Simply visit marquee.tv and use the promo code squared to dive into the world of arts like never before. Bring the arts home with Marquee TV. The events calendar is filling up here at Intelligence Squared, and to create each one, we obviously rely on some brilliant guests and onstage talent. But behind the scenes, there's also a producer, a production team, and the budget in the mix too. You've got to keep an eye on all of that stuff in one place. NetSuite is the number one cloud financial system, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, and HR into one platform, slashing manual tasks and errors. And you can cut the cost of maintaining multiple systems because it's super easy to get started. NetSuite exists in the cloud, you see, no hardware needed. So you're cutting IT costs too. That's why over 37,000 companies have already made the move. And now, by popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. Head to netsuite.com/squared. That's netsuite.com/squared. netsuite.com/squared.
You're a podcast listener, and this is a podcast ad. Reach great listeners like yourself with podcast advertising from Lips and Ads. Choose from hundreds of top podcasts offering host endorsements, or run a reproduced ad like this one across thousands of shows to reach your target audience with Lips and Ads. Go to lipsandads.com now. That's LIBSYN ads.com.
Let's turn to your third touchstone, Bob Dylan's Mr. Tambourine Man. So tell us why this was the first track that was released on the acoustic side of the March 65 album, Bringing It All Back Home. Why this one?
Well, as I say, it could have been a lot of tracks, but and by the way, I'm fine with Dylan winning the Nobel Prize, but I just think all of us should be given Grammys in that case.
That's a brilliant, by the way.
What happened was, when I was in my early days at boarding school at Rugby, a friend of mine in the same boarding house as I was in got hold of a couple of Dylan albums, and was very, very excited, and summoned me into his little cubicle. We used to call them studies, but they were really about the size of a shoebox. And he said, sit down and listen to this. And then he said, don't say anything until you've heard the whole record. And he put on the LP, the vinyl LP, and played the two sides of Bringing It All Back Home. And I said, you know, in love with it. And I opened my mouth and he said, no, you have to listen to it all again. He made me listen to the whole album again. And by the end of that, I was a Dylan fan, and I have remained so ever since, although his voice isn't what it used to be, sadly.
And you've seen him a lot in concert?
I have seen him quite a few times, yeah. Most recently, about a year ago, he had a gig at the Beacon Theatre here in New York, And I went, and I mean, he's really not singing anymore. He's sort of doing something halfway between growling and shouting. I mean, his band is terrific, and the words are great, but, you know, he used to be, I mean, he never had a great singing voice, but he had a very expressive singing voice. And he had very unique phrasing, which is why very, very few people have been able to improve on a Dylan song. You know, people cover Dylan all the time, you know.
That was going to be my next question. I mean, loads of people have done Mr. Tambourine Man. I mean, are there any that you think match it?
The most famous one is The Byrds did it, but The Byrds turn it into this kind of tum-ti-tum song, you know, which it sort of isn't. And people have tried to cover Like a Rolling Stone, and it's no good. And I mean, the one song of his that I think, well, there's a few songs that people have tried to cover successfully, like Just Like a Woman has had a lot of very good cover versions, and I Shall Be Released, and songs like that, you know. But Tambourine Man, I don't think anybody, I mean, The Byrds version is pathetic, really. But I remember it struck me, first of all, it's a story song, you know, it's a long narrative song. And it's a long song, so it actually breaks what used to be the kind of rule in the early 60s, that pop songs had to be under 3 minutes long, you know, and suddenly you have much longer songs coming out of Dylan. And a bit later, when he released Blonde on Blonde, One of the four sides of the double album is a single song. Sad Eyed Lady of the Lowlands is the whole side of the album. And so he got people used, in a way, I guess, in the way that J.K. Rowling got young kids used to reading very long books, Dylan got people like me used to listening to very long songs, and finding the richness of them. Also, of course, it's a psychedelic song. I mean, it's a song about, I mean, Mr. Tambourine Man is a drug dealer, essentially, you know. And so the song is about an acid trip.
Hasn't Dylan always denied that, though?
Yeah, he could deny it all he likes. I mean, you know, okay, he denies it. So what? Take me disappearing down the smoke rings of my mind, really? And I never did acid, you know. I mean, I was always much too scared to take those drugs. And so in a way, my only experience of an acid trip is through Mr. Tambourine Man and songs like that.
So you're a man of words. So, you know, reflect on the lyrics. I mean, you talk about this as a long, I think it's about 5.5 minutes long, this song. Let's just reflect a little with you then on the kind of surrealism of those lyrics.
I agree. Well, I mean, that's the thing that most appealed to me about it is the surrealism, the kind of fabulist nature of the song. As you know, that's kind of been my inclination as a writer anyway. And Dylan, I mean, Dylan's writing is very beautiful, and it showed me a lot, you know, a lot of his writing. What I resist a little bit is people saying that Dylan is a great poet, you know, because to my mind the words and the music are so entwined, you know, that I don't know what it would be like for somebody to read Bob Dylan's lyrics who had never heard the music. Some of the songs I think would not hold up. I think actually Tambourine Man is the one that comes very close to holding up. I think it's actually lyrically very powerful. And I mean, for example, I used to be able to do this. I used to have Bob Dylan memory competitions with Christopher Hitchens. And let me just tell you, trying to have a memory competition with Christopher Hitchens is the dumbest move you could ever make. because Christopher had a retentive power for verse and for poetry, greater than anybody I've ever known. And you know, you could say to Christopher, Shelley, and he would do 20 minutes, you know, just from memory. He could do Byron, you know, et cetera. And he could do Dylan. So we used to have these competitions, which I would always lose, but they were enjoyable. And I used to be able to do Tambourine Man from memory, but you know, now I'm 73. So it's not quite what it was. I actually think the last verse of Tambourine Man is the one which is most poetically beautiful. So maybe I'll just recite that. It's the one which goes, take me, this is one, the drug one that I mentioned. Take me disappearing through the smoke rings of my mind, down the foggy ruins of time, far past the frozen leaves, the haunted, frightened trees, out to the windy beach, far from the twisted reach of crazy sorrow. That's very good, that. Yes, to dance beneath the diamond sky with one hand waving free, silhouetted by the sea, circled by the circus sands, with all memory and fate driven deep beneath the waves, let me forget about today until tomorrow. Hey, Mr. Tambourine Man, play a song for me, etc. I mean, that is poetry, as close as anything. And so pictorial, you know, it's full of pictures all the way through, you know, the haunted, frightened trees, the twisted reach of crazy sorrow. I mean, that's very good stuff. So yeah, that's why, as I say, he is a great writer. He is a great writer. And actually, one of the things I think there's a lot of very great lyricists right now, of whom Dylan is very near the, at the pinnacle, you know, and then Paul Simon, Joni Mitchell, you know, Tom Waits, any number of them. And one of the arguments I would have when I was president of PEN America was say that we need to broaden our understanding of what literature is, you know, and that there is no way really that you can say that these writers are inferior to most novelists who get their books published. You know, they're actually at least as good, if not better, than most novelists. And after a very long fight, I managed for some time to persuade Penn to start granting lifetime achievement awards for lyrics writing. And Dylan said he didn't want it. He said...
He was holding out for the Nobel Prize, Salman.
He really was. He really was, it turns out. But like in the first year, we would give it to two artists every 2 years rather than one a year, just because sort of more fun. And the first year, we gave it to Leonard Cohen and Chuck Berry. And they both came, and it was an extraordinary moment because they'd never met. And Leonard Cohen said this very sweet thing about Chuck Berry. Who he said, you know, everything began with Chuck Berry. He said if Beethoven hadn't rolled over, there wouldn't have been room for any of us.
Salman, thank you so much for sharing with us your three touchstones. We have got about 10 minutes for questions, so I'm hoping that you'll keep your answers short so we can get as many in as possible. So the first one is, in Golden House, you write, stacks of ingots, sacks of doubloons, racks of louis d'or and buckets of ducats. I wondered how important it is to you how your writing sounds when it's read out loud.
Well, I mean, thanks. I mean, I think the answer is, I pay a lot of attention to the music of the words, you know, I mean, just it's really continuing on from what we were saying about lyric writing. I do sometimes, not always, sometimes read passages aloud to myself to see if they sound right, you know, because actually the ear is a very good judge of mistakes. You know, you can't fool yourself when you hear yourself saying something that isn't right. It gets past your defenses. So, yeah, sometimes I do that. And particularly with long dialogue sections, because with the difficulty of dialogue is to differentiate properly so that the two people each sounds like themselves, you know. And it should be possible to write dialogue without having to say who's speaking. You should know that from how they're speaking. You know, and so, yeah, I do. I pay attention a lot to the music of it. And yeah, I'm lucky in that I have for the last three or four books, had this wonderful series of readings and on audiobooks, and which are actually much better than I could do myself. So I'm grateful for that. And yes, I do pay attention.
The next one is from Frank in London. I couldn't help notice your three touchstones were an object, a piece of literature, and a piece of music. In the current century, it would seem that children and young people might encounter far fewer objects, far less literature, at least in the traditional sense, and a more hyper-commercialised music. Do you imagine in 50 years, a teen today might be able to say her first iPhone was a touchstone and in as meaningful a way? Has something fundamental changed? Do you think?
Yeah, I mean, I think some fundamental things change all the time. You know, I mean, that's sort of all right. It's all right that the world changes. And it may well be that an iPhone is a touchstone. I mean, iPhones are colossally transformative in our culture. I mean, you know, even at the political level, I mean, I think one of the reasons why we're having this conversation about racism is because people are able to record racial abuses on their smartphones. It's not that racial abuses just began, you know, they've been going on throughout the history of this country, but now people can see them and it changes the conversation. So I'm absolutely willing to believe that iPhone could be a transformative object, you know, but it's true that, you know, I think the questioner is wrong about children's literature, because I think children's literature is actually thriving right now. You know, I think that it's an age of wonderful children's writers. I mean, you know, ranging from little children to young adults, but, you know, Jackie Woodson, Neil Gaiman, you know, all sorts of people. I think children are well served right now, you know, by rights, by books, and seem to read them still read them in substantial quantities. But I do think that the world is different. And I mean, I have no idea 50 years down the line what people will think of as their talismanic objects. I hope one of them is a book. That would be nice to think.
This is a question from Christopher Clement Davis. Was it reading Joyce that inspired you to commit to being a writer, or is it too simplistic to say that? What other factors tipped the balance for you? Because you, for as long as you can remember, you've wanted to be a writer.
Yeah, long before I read Joyce, when I was too little to read Joyce. I mean, Joyce actually was kind of, as I said, was almost off-putting because the scale of the talent and the achievement was so great that it made me think, well, I can't do that, you know. But yeah, I mean, I was a bookworm as a kid, and I think a lot of writers come out of readers. You know, a lot of people who are in love with the experience of being with a book, being inside a book as a reader, conceive of the desire to write the thing that they love being inside. You know, and certainly that was my experience. You know, that I began as a reader. And when I was a little boy, I mean, my parents told me that I would say to their friends when asked, what did I want to do? You know, I didn't say I wanted to be an astronaut. You know, I said I wanted to be a writer. And of course, when you say that as a kid, you have no idea what it means. And I think all you know is that it means I love books. You know, and to want to be a writer is a completely different thing from being able to be a writer. You know, and when I started trying to be a writer, my great fear was that I would not be able to do the thing which was the only thing that I'd ever wanted to do, because I had no plan B, really.
Well, you obviously didn't need one, even if you didn't know that you didn't need one. This one is from Robert Swannell. I hope I'm pronouncing your name correctly. I was a pupil at rugby school at exactly the same time as you. Unlike you, I was useless academically, but I do have 1,431 separate Bob Dylan tracks on my iTunes. Astonishingly, having not returned to the school for over 30 years, I ended up chairing the governing body. It's now a much better and kinder place with 50% girls. Other than discovering Bob Dylan, what impact, if any, did the experience of your 4.5 years there have on your literary career?
Oh, that's so interesting. Well, yeah, I'm sure girls are a big improvement. I felt that the quality of teaching was incredibly high and inspired me. I mean, I had teachers, history teachers, who gave me a love of history, and I ended up being what I studied at university. I was actually very bad at French until I met a particular French teacher who inspired me, and I then became rather good at French. He was a gentleman called Mr. Lewis, whose initials were PG, which meant that schoolboys, of course, would refer to him as the pig. So Pig Lewis was the person who made me want to read French. So that's all of that, the academic side of being at the school, I would give very high marks to, you know, but it was also a time when I had my first experiences of racial prejudice. You know, so there's that side of it too. I remember coming into my little cubicle and finding a racist slogan written on the wall, kind of "Wogs go home." You know, and I remember coming into another time, coming into my study and finding that my homework had been torn up and left in pieces on the floor. And so, yeah, so I learned that too. I learned that too. And that may not have been a bad lesson to learn either.
Let's just end where we began, in fact, with a question about partition. Do you think partition really could have been avoided? Was it not a capitulation to Jinnah's demands to avoid a threat of civil war?
Well, the point is, the question is when, you know, because you're right, by the end, you know, by the time you get to 1947, it's not avoidable. But remember that Jinnah didn't start off on the partition side of the argument. He started off on the other side and was basically driven out of the Congress Party by what he thought of as Gandhi's hostility to his leadership, you know, and which may be right or wrong, it's hard to say. There was a particular presidential election inside the Congress Party where Gandhi came down against his opponent, and as a result, Jinnah was not elected as the president of the Congress, and that's when he began to split away from it and join the separatists. I think there's a moment in the early 40s when it could have gone another way, that Jinnah could have been kept inside the Congress Party. And in 1940, there's the Quit India Resolution, and at that point, a lot of the Congress leaders are arrested and jailed. And the Muslim League steps into their shoes and to assist with government, and that's seen as being betrayal. You know, and I think maybe after the Quit India Resolution, it was impossible to prevent it. But at some point in the late 30s, the beginning of the 40s, I think it was still possible. I mean, it didn't happen. You know, and one of the things I was taught as a history student was never ask the question, what if? It's hard enough to understand what actually happened. You know, what if is an uninteresting question.
There's just one final question. I think we've got time for it. About the possibility of you turning to India again as a subject matter of your fiction, particularly in the context of Modi. I mean, India appears in all shapes and sizes in many of your novels, but I suppose the question is referring back, I suppose, to Midnight's Children.
Well, I mean, never say never, you know. But at the moment, I mean, I'm very interested in what's happening where I actually live, you know, and in facing up to that, and not, you know, I mean, not even politically, because as one of the earlier questioners suggested, you know, the world is transforming in all sorts of ways at a very high speed, and that's interesting, you know, to live in a time of very, very rapid change has always been inspiring to literature. You know, I mean, Shakespeare lived at a time in which the English language was transforming very rapidly. And he became at the heart of that transformation. I mean, so much of the language we now use was stuff that Shakespeare made up, you know. But to live at a time of transformation is a highly creative experience, you know. And so, you know, I mean, I'm trying to keep a hold of that, you know, trying to ride that horse.
Salman Rushdie, thank you so much for a fantastic conversation. It's been so delightful hearing about your touchstones and so much more.